The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Yo, 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 and welcome back to Creeps and Crimes
Podcast.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Morgan. Happy Thursday. Happy week after Thanksgiving. Are we? I'm lying.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it is.
Happy week after Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. I hope we are decompressed from our family time. I hope it was wonderful.
And how are your tummies feeling?
How's everyone feeling? Are you still eating leftovers? Because I hope I am.
I'm so excited for my morning biscuits with leftover turkey, mustard, mayonnaise. And dressing.
God, that is amazing.
Yeah.
But
you
little side of cream corn.
Yeah, you know me. I love some weird shit.
I would love to go to Thanksgiving at your house because I know your mom makes banging.
Dude, she called me she called me this morning. So this is hilarious. Guys, let me tell I'm the CEO this week. I'm the CEO of Mental Breakdowns, Venti Depressi Minty Beads. And
extra shot of Dispressi.
Dispressi and Pilates.
You are the CEO of Pilates. That's what I thought you were going to go with.
Yeah, I was going to do it at first. I was like, you know, I gotta loop in the Minty Bees.
This week, I am the CEO of mean fucking looks and staring everyone in public down because they piss me off.
Yeah.
The CEO of being a chronic bitch.
Yeah, chronic bitch this week. That's correct. By the way, we are recording this the week before Thanksgiving.
Hey. A lot going on since then.
A lot going on. You guys are episode number 4 for us today.
Yeah.
We are on a grind. I have off today. We've been day recording. I work this weekend. Mm-hmm. So we're just vibing on a little Tuesday.
Yeah. You know, I love the day recordings. I really do. But we talk so much.
We do.
During day recordings that my throat is like so scratchy by now. We've done 1, 2, 3... Like technically 4 in all.
Yeah.
This is number 5. Like this is a lot. It's a lot. So we are ready to get, you know, creepy with you. But before we do, where was I going? Oh, my mom. So like I said, I'm CEO of Pilates. And I go to Pilates this morning. I go to my 8 a.m. class.
Well, I tracked you because you're like, I'm going to 9 a.m. to 9 to 10. And I woke up at like 8:45 and I was like, oh, she's already at the gym.
Yep.
Or she's right outside my house.
She's really literally right beside me.
And a little bit later, like 9:10, I see you whipping it back to your house. I'm like, damn, she woke up early as fuck.
Well, I woke up. I like booked the 9 o'clock because I was up until like 12:30 last night. That's when I went downstairs to get in the shower. So I didn't go to bed until probably 2, like after getting everything done
tonight.
Yeah, I'm so excited to sleep. And I get downstairs and I had already booked that 9 a.m. class. But I was beyond that 12-hour window. Whenever I go to bed really late, I inherently wake up earlier. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah, not me.
I have to like wake up really early when I go to bed late. So I was like, you know, I'll just wait until the morning. And if I'm up, I'll go to, I was even going to go to the 7 o'clock one because I had to finish up my script. So I woke up this morning at 7. I was like, no shot, I'm going to the 7 o'clock class. But I could make it to the 8 o'clock class and they had a spot open. So I just, you know, late cancellation fee on the other one for $10, but I could have just called and they would have switched me, like no big deal. But I didn't feel like talking to anyone. So anyways, yeah, that I'm on my way back from Pilates, and while I'm in Pilates, my mom's like blowing my shit up because normally me and mom will drink our coffee and watch Good Morning America and Live with Kelly and Ryan, or not Kelly and Ryan anymore, Kelly and Mark. Anyway, she's like, why are my texts not going through? So I finally got, and she's like, oh my God, you're working out? What the hell? That's crazy, girl. And I was like, yeah. She's like, well, I was just calling to, you know, make sure that everything that you got, the sides that you wanted. I just feel like we're missing something. I'm like, okay, well, read me your list. And she's like, we have the CoCam. We've got the turkey.
Oh, I'm like, were you talking about landscaping right now?
No, we're not talking about landscaping yet. That was the later deal.
Yeah. CoCam, so that's a must.
She's
on
like,
Tanya's list.
CoCam, turkey, dressing, of course.
Dressing is stuffing, by the way.
Yeah, dressing is stuffing. But I think that there is a difference between dressing and stuffing. Dressing to me, like you can cut it in blocks and it's firm. Stuffing is when it's like you scoop it and you dump it.
All of mine is never really soupy.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be like soupy. But like, do you cook it in a casserole dish or do you like break it up in like
chunkies? My mom puts it in a casserole dish, but she also stuffs the turkey with it.
Okay, yeah, I don't do that. I don't do that side of it.
This year, sorry to interrupt your story. This year, I'm having a freaking deep fried turkey, bitch. I have had it. And my brother is like huge. We're going to Tampa for Thanksgiving. My brother is huge in deep frying. He has his own little thing with wings and stuff. And I begged him. I was like, I need to try this. Can you please deep fry
it? It's so good. You're going to be obsessed. You need a little bit of gravy.
My mom is being so ridiculous. Sarah's like, all right, what do you need me to like get for like Thanksgiving and stuff? Like what's on the list? And my mom, what, is everything okay?
Yeah. Just we got another email.
My mom was like, don't worry, I'll bring everything. And Sarah's like, you don't have to do that. My mom's like, no, I'll bring the mixer, my pots and pans. And Sarah's like, okay, Bevan, like, you just do whatever the fuck you want. Anyway, tell me your story. So she's texting you the list. CoCam, dressing. You
know, no, she's on the phone with me when I'm driving home. She's like, all right, so we got CoCam, we got dressing, we got turkey, we got rolls.
I'm watering.
She's like, all right, let's go through the sides because I feel like I'm missing something. She's like, I got cream corn. I'm like, all right, green beans. Yep, got it. Mashed potatoes. Yep, 100%. Skillet fried sweet potatoes, mac and cheese, of course. And then I think there was like one other thing, but she's like, I'm missing something. I'm like, bitch, who are you cooking for? Like, this is a ton of food. What are you talking about? It's only me, Logan, Lola, Jameson, Phoebe, mom, dad, Nana, and ma'am. That's it. We don't need to cook for the entire neighborhood. I'm like, those are 32 different sides. I'm very excited about them, but we don't need any more.
Right.
We don't need any more. She's like, do you think I should add something else? I'm like, I think you're good, bitch. I think it's good. She's deviled eggs. That's what I forgot. I was like, okay, yeah, you have to have deviled eggs. That's a must have. That goes along with the turkey and the dressing. You can't do anything else without it.
Yeah, I'm not a deviled egg.
But yeah, you know, went through and walked through the list and she's like, what do we want for dessert? So I talked through dessert with her and I've got to figure out what I'm making. Obviously, we have to have a pumpkin pie, but it was between the homemade banana pudding or the berry trifle. And I love banana pudding. Don't get me wrong. But on Thanksgiving, by the time you're done eating, that's so much flavor. You can't like, it's just not, it doesn't feel fresh.
Right.
So I'd rather have like a little thin slice of pumpkin pie with some whipped cream and then a big bowl of the berry trifle because it's like angel food cake with, I don't think it's banana. I think it's just like vanilla, not yogurt, like custard. And you layer that and then you put a bunch of berries, like a bunch of fresh berries on it. And then you do the angel food cake, and I think you do Cool Whip in it as well. And so on and
that
so forth.
That sounds good.
It's so good.
My mom usually, we are strictly pie family, 100%. Yeah. But my mom is great at baking pies. So I'm never going to say she's great at cooking, but that bitch can bake her ass off. And her apple pies are so fucking
I would love an apple pie
good.
Right now. I could
so
go
good.
One. You know, I have stuff to make downstairs is a bunch. I have everything that you could ever imagine that you would need in a baking kitchen right now downstairs. For what? Don't know. Yeah. Bought it though.
As a gag, I should go to Dollywood and buy a $220, 20-pound apple pie and drive it to Florida.
I think you should.
That would be hilarious.
That would be fucking hilarious.
Are you kidding?
I 100% support this DeLulu energy.
I think it needs to happen. My mom would geek out.
No, your mom would geek, but honestly, I don't want her to think that she can't make your apple pie. And also, Bethany, I need you to send me an apple pie.
Yeah, hers are really good. We berry pick at home. I don't know what kind of berries are like native to Tennessee.
What we get blueberries, blackberries. Not blueberries, blackberries, strawberries. You can go pick them some places. Yeah, good.
She makes
raspberries
like
a lot.
Yeah, her black raspberry pie is phenomenal.
Dude, my grandparents used to make black raspberry everything because their backyard was lined with blackberries and they had that big their house. My grandparents
I say ours
like
too
house.
But my parents had me on the fucking street in backwoods Pennsylvania, pulled over
covered
on the side
ticks.
Of the road, covered in ticks head to toe, knee deep in thorns,
picking
berries, and we all had a bucket, and if that bucket wasn't filled by the time my mom and dad's were filled, then guess what, they went to the truck and we stayed out there picking by ourselves.
Here was my issue. I would eat one, put one in the bucket. Put one in the bucket.
And I would actually go over to my mom's bucket and grab handfuls and eat it.
Yeah, me too.
You know how dirty those things are?
Yeah, but it's probably why I got a great immune system. I don't.
Right.
I don't have an autoimmune disease.
I wish I could. That's what I want. I wonder if they are. Are they native to Tennessee?
Yeah. Wild berries. Yeah, everywhere.
Because I need to plant whatever house. Whenever I get a house, I'm going to need to plant those.
Yeah, I want to have like a wild. I want to have a wild flower and berry garden and herb garden, of course. Duh.
Yeah. Our strawberries never really made it well at home. It was just too.
My strawberries down here in Tennessee still popping off in your backyard. You'll get one or two every now and again.
Yeah, Ollie eats something off the trees. I don't know what he's eating. It was probably not good.
Oh, those red berries that are on the trees?
Aren't those toxic?
There are some red berries on the trees.
Oh, I'm wondering what he's been up there snagging.
Yeah. red berries.
Those are toxic, aren't they?
Yeah, 100%. I think actually they're not red. They're the dark ones. They look like blueberries, but they're not blueberries.
Probably still toxic.
Still toxic. Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Love that for Mr. Ollie Man.
He is something else.
Yeah, he is.
He's so silly.
He is so silly. He's so funny. Okay, guys, I guess we'll jump into this episode.
Yeah, if you're driving, throw that shit on cruise control.
If you got a glass, pour that shit up.
And let's get creepy.
It's gifting season.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Burning that hole in your pocket.
Yeah, burning that hole for real in your pocket. And guess who is not going to let you go over budget this year? Rocket Money.
They will alert you when you're spending a little bit too much.
And when you're getting a little too close to that, you know, budget that you set for yourself.
Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills all in one place so that you can have a little extra money to spend this holiday season.
Rocket Money also will let you monitor all of your expenses in one place, recommend custom budgets based on your past spending, and they'll even send you notifications when you've reached your spending limits, which is exactly what we were talking about. And I got an alert the other day when I was buying gifts for my mother-in-law, but I just love her so much. I just want to, you know, I just want to shower my girl in gifts. And right. I just forget.
You are a big gift giver.
I am a big gift giver, and I just forget sometimes that I'm not a millionaire. So Rocket Money is always there to remind me that, hey, you're not a millionaire. You know?
Tone it down, man.
Chill out.
With over 5 million users and counting, Rocket Money has helped save its customers an average of $720 a year and $1 billion in total savings so far.
And Rocket Money can even negotiate to lower your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is just take a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. So stop wasting money on things that you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and manage your money the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/creepsandcrimes.
That's rocketmoney.com/creepsandcrimes.
rocketmoney.com/creepsandcrimes, saving us this holiday season. Okay, Morgan, before you tell us what you have for us today, guys, this is not being recorded. We can not today.
It's not happening. Sorry.
I already have a bald spot in my head. I can't. Have you seen my bald spot?
Dude, I have one here now too.
We're not good.
No, I noticed it when I was slicking back my hair the other day. I said,
it's both on our left sides.
Yeah, I said,
we
must
be overworking the left sides of our brain.
Yeah, but we have bald spots, so we're not on camera.
Thank you so much.
So today I am talking about what is famously known as the Morbihan and Jourdain incident. So I want you to imagine that you accidentally time travel back in time. And like, picture me and you.
Okay.
We're coworkers, mm-hmm. we're business partners. We go to fucking France and we're touring something and we travel back in time and we see fucking Marie Antoinette.
Oh, okay.
Pretty cool, right?
We'd be like, bitch.
Yeah. Be like, what's that? Tell us everything. Supposedly, that is the case of a couple of bestie girls named Charlotte Moberly and Eleanor Jourdain.
Shut up.
So Charlotte Ann Moberly was born in Winchester on September 16th, 1846. She was the 10th child born out of 15 kids.
Whoa.
Whoa. Her father was George Moberly and her mother was Mary Ann. Charlotte, as a kid, was a big academia kiddo, 444 on the clock right now.
On the clock right now. We saw 222 and 444.
Yeah. She was taught at home by a private teacher and her mother, and she gained basic skills in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. So she was very intelligent.
Yeah.
In her young adult life, she participated in discussions about the Oxford movement, which was a huge ordeal. And she, I'm telling you, she's like a literal teenager, like 17, 18, joining these discussions and was actively a part of the movement.
Wow.
And this was the movement of the high church members of the Church of England who wanted to reinstate some older Christian traditions of faith and inclusion into Anglican liturgy and theology. One of the leaders of this movement was a man named John Keble, whose wife was actually Charlotte's godmother. So that's how she became involved in that. And because her father was the Bishop of Salisbury.
Oh, yeah.
I know we say that wrong. We've said it before.
Salisbury. I think I want to say it's Salisbury.
Salisbury. Sorry, guys.
Sorry.
I'm going to butcher a lot of names in here. I'm just going to forewarn you right the fuck now.
We're trying. We really do. What's crazy is
don't speak
French. You guys are so rough on us. You're like, you don't even care to try. We do. It's just hard. We're still not good. It's not our strong suit. And we never claim to be professionals.
So if that's something that pisses you off about us, then don't listen to my part.
Just don't give a 5-star. Listen to my part either. For sure, don't listen to my part if you're really torn up about pronunciation and grammar. Don't.
Mine's going to be a rough one. So Charlotte was the secretary for her father, who was the Bishop of Salisbury in 1869. And both of these events, her involvement in the Oxford movement and being the secretary for her father, led to her taking over as the first principal of St. Hugh's College, Oxford.
Oh, wow.
Principal. She was in mother frickin' charge.
You know, she was in her little power suit.
Yeah. And she was a member of the governing council of the college.
Okay.
Now, Eleanor Jourdain, her soon-to-be bestie, was born in Ashbourne, Derbyshire, on November 16th, 1863. Her father was Vicar Francis Jourdain, and her mother was Emily, who was the daughter of a very famous surgeon named Charles Clay.
Okay.
An English surgeon. Eleanor was the firstborn out of 10 children. She's the firstborn, the eldest daughter. She was a bad motherfucking bitch.
So I got to know, Tim.
Something about them firstborns.
Something about them firstborns.
She went to a private day school in Manchester, which was not common at the time for girls to be in a day school in the 1860s. That just didn't happen. And this followed by her college year studying at Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford. She then quickly started her professional life as the secretary to the wife of the Archbishop of Canterbury, because really that's even an educated woman. That's the best you can get, your secretary, point blank period.
Right.
But quickly realized that, you know what? I was built for more. I have more in store for me. And she was advanced as the assistant mistress at Tottenham High School and later Clifton High School. In 1892, she co-founded Corn Collegiate School in Watford, which was a private boarding and day school for the girls.
Oh, fuck yeah.
And by 1900, she became their headmistress.
Yes, she did.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, she Eleanor. Did. 3 years later, she decided to leave and she wanted to move to Paris. So she does. And during so, she starts researching symbolism. And this is where she would go on to publish tons of articles on symbolism in both French and English, and was awarded a doctorate in 1904 by the University of Paris.
Wow.
Female getting a doctorate in the 1900s.
Yeah.
Impressive.
That's so crazy and cool.
After this, her research caught the eye of a lot of people. And so she was invited by another Oxford alumna, Miss Charlotte Mobley, who was the acting principal of St. Hugh's Hall, to come to St. Hugh's and serve as her vice principal.
Yeah.
And this is where our stories meet up. Our timelines cross. Our girlies are best friends. We got St. Hugh's Hall, Principal Charlotte, and Vice Principal Eleanor.
I mean, these queens.
Dynamic,
these are just
educated, iconic motherfucking duo.
And their names, too. It's like Eleanor and Charlotte. Yeah, we're here.
Yeah. So before inviting Eleanor to come be vice president, Charlotte decided, you know what? Maybe we should actually, I'd love to get to know you a little more.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's okay with you, I'm going to come out and see you. So Charlotte travels out to Paris and she stays with Eleanor in her apartment.
Okay, let me tell you this right now. This was not necessary. She just was like, how can I get a ride off to go hang out with my bestie in Paris?
How can I go hang out in Paris?
Yeah.
Someone who's clearly aligned with me, mm-hmm. the same way we were raised, the same big, large mm-hmm. families, educated females, mm-hmm. went to college.
Worked
she was
our
a headmistress.
Off.
I'm a principal. Mm-hmm. Like, she created this. I created that. Like, they were fucking just icons.
Yeah. She's like, let me get a ride off out of that.
Yeah. So Charlotte travels out to Paris and she stays with Eleanor in her apartment. And this is really where our story starts. While in Paris, the two decided that they wanted to go visit the Palace of Versailles.
Oh, yeah.
How do you say that?
Versailles.
So they decided they wanted to go visit the Palace of Versailles. And this was the start of a several stop tour that they were going to do to kind of get to know one another, get some research under their belt, just two besties living life in Paris.
Yeah.
Away from the kiddos at the school.
Yes.
So they left on August 10th, 1901, and they traveled by train to Versailles. Once arrived, the two girls were not very impressed by the palace.
Okay, great.
So they were like, okay, yeah, that's cool. But
yeah, you know, I would do that differently.
I'm not, I wouldn't have done it like that. Like, yeah. Nice try, though.
That tile's like not for me.
So they decided that they were going to walk through the gardens to reach the Grand Trianon. And once they got there, they realized that, fuck, this is close to the public. So the Grand Trianon was just like an kind of not connected to the Palace of Versailles, but mm-hmm. it was just like off site, just a little bit, quick walk through the garden. It was just like an outdoor like chateau that they would go, and whoever was living at the palace would venture out. Usually sometimes with their mistress, like if the king had a mistress, they would live in the chateau and the others.
So it's just like a guest house.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just a little guest housey poo. So anyway, they're walking through the gardens to reach the Grand Trianon. And when they get there, it's fucking closed. And they're like, okay, well, this trip is like really shitting on our dicks.
Right? Yeah.
They were not really good. Happy. And they were using what was called the Baedeker guidebook. And this was showing them every like important piece. Like it wasn't just like, come visit the palace. Mm-hmm. It was like, come visit this. This is the garden. This is why the garden is important. This is what happened here. Mm-hmm. This is what happened at this little gazebo. Like so much, so forth. Anyway. So once they were trying to leave the Grand Trianon, they believe that they had missed a turn and this would have taken them back to Main Avenue, but they weren't at Main Avenue and now they're lost.
Oh, great.
On the palace grounds. They're lost.
Dude, me and you would have been so over it by that point.
We'd be like, missed the fucking turn. We told me it was right here. Oh, and you know there, you probably got to walk back 3 miles, turn left, circle around the roundabout.
And you know that it's like the 1800s, so they're in some crazy shit that they're having to wear back
1901.
Yeah. But still, they're in some psychotic shit that they're wearing. It's
they're
hot.
Just pissed.
They're both sweaty. They're like,
the
why
palace
the fuck
was
did
a disappointment.
Yeah.
The Grand Trianon was closed.
I knew we should have gone
then
to
the
winery.
They missed the wrong turn. Yeah, they want the wine. They want the alcohol, food, even.
Yeah, just they're starving.
So
they're hangry.
They're following this guidebook and they're trying to get back to Main Avenue, but they missed the turn and now they're lost.
Yeah, great.
So they keep walking and they soon find themselves in this tiny, like, back alley lane.
Oh.
And Charlotte starts noticing a woman in one of the windows. So they're in this alley lane, but there's like buildings on both sides of them.
Got it.
And there's a woman in one of the windows who's like shaking out an old white cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Eleanor notices like up ahead of them, there's a small old deserted farmhouse.
Mm.
So they start kind of walking that way to like get out because like the alley was a little creepy to them.
Yeah. I would not want to be in an alley.
And as soon as they entered that alley, they both reported to feel, quote, dreariness and oppression pour over them.
Oh, yeah. No,
like,
we're
they
running.
Were like sick to their stomach and they're like, this is not where we're supposed to be.
Right.
We need to get out of here.
It's like an unspoken thing.
So Eleanor sees this farmhouse. She's like, let's go up there out of this little fucking creepy ass back alleyway.
Lift up your dress and let's run.
Let's run. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So during this, while they're walking out, they run into some men who looked like possible palace gardeners. And these men just kind of like sternly looked at Charlotte and Eleanor and they were like, you need to move on. Keep walking. Like, keep on. Like, you're not supposed to be back here. Keep walking.
What do you think we're fucking doing, bro?
Like, we're lost. Thank you. Charlotte said that these men were, quote, very dignified officials dressed in long grayish green coats with small three-cornered hats. Like the points, you know, like old school.
Yeah.
And Eleanor then spots a cottage off to the side from where they were. Like, so now they're like, okay, these guys are behind us. We were going to the farmhouse, but now there's a little cottage. And she sees a woman that's standing like on the porch of the cottage and she's holding out a jug to a little girl that's like in the doorway of this cottage. And she described it as almost like a living picture, like knowing that what she was seeing was not real, but it was right in front of their face. But like she recognized this specific image of what was happening, kind of like a painting, but she couldn't put her finger on what she was seeing.
Okay.
Charlotte did not notice this cottage, but did remember what everything looked and felt like during this moment.
Okay.
She said, quote, everything suddenly looked unnatural, therefore unpleasant. Even the trees seemed to become flat and lifeless, like wood worked in tapestry. There were no effects of light and shade, and no wind stirred the trees. So it was like they were caught in time.
Yeah.
And like this was all like
layered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't know how to describe. I know what they're saying, but I don't understand how to describe it.
I understand exactly what you're. Okay. Here's an example. You know how this is so dumb. You know how the original animations that like Disney, like that were such a big like thing that he did. That was like such a big deal. And I think the first one that they did it in was Aurora, Sleeping Beauty. Was 5 layers of art on the reels. So like,
yes,
you did 4 different pieces and you put them up and they were different, you know, backgrounds and shit. So it was giving foreground and background.
Yeah.
That's what I'm envisioning.
Yeah, I'm with you on that too. So they're seeing this lady in the cottage and the little girl, and they're now approaching the edge of these woods.
Man-made dimension. Sorry. It came to my tongue. I had to
fake,
get it out.
Fake but real.
Yeah, fake but real.
So they reach the edge of these woods near the Temple des Amours, which was this garden folly that sat outside of Versailles.
The Temple of Love?
It's, I think it's like Iamor.
Okay.
So maybe the Temple of Love. Yeah. And this Garden Folly looked like a, think of like Greek and Roman, like column, like gazebo. Mm,
yeah.
So it's just like this little like circle building, but it's just got columns all around it. Mm-hmm. And it's just in this beautiful garden.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, let's go take a look at that. That looks gorgeous.
Looks cutesy.
So they start walking towards it and they come up on a man that was sitting on the bench in the garden, like right outside this folly or this mm-hmm. gazebo. He was wearing a cloak and he had a large, and they said shady, quote, shady hat.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlotte said, quote, his appearance was most repulsive, its expression odious, and his complexion was dark and rough. Like they were not getting good vibes from this guy.
Yeah.
He was looking out of time. Like he wasn't looking like anything. Out of place. Exactly.
Like ominously out
of
place. And
Eleanor says that this man slowly starts to turn his face. And when they see his face, it's marked with smallpox all over his face.
Oh, fuck.
And his complexion was very dark. His expression was evil. It was unseeing. And though they did not feel that he was looking particularly at them,
mm-hmm.
it was like they felt this repugnance to keep going past him.
Yeah.
And that's a quote from Eleanor. I would never say repugnance. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah. She just got a weird vibe and they were like, let's keep our eyes forward and walk fast.
Like he's looking directly in our direction, but he's not looking at us. And we need to get the fuck out of here. Yeah. Like that guy's got smallpox sitting in a garden at Versailles.
Smallpox plus bad vibes and a cloak. I'm out.
I'm immediately out.
Yeah.
As they're walking past him, another man who they said was very tall and he had large, dark eyes, curly black hair, came up to them.
Okay.
And pointed them towards the way to get to the, not the Grand Trianon, but the Petite Trianon.
Okay.
And he was like, you need to go that way. Like, you're not supposed to be in here.
Okay.
So he starts pointing at them. So now they are making contact with whoever they're seeing in the garden. But they're getting the impression that they are not allowed in the garden right now. What are they doing here?
Yeah.
While walking out of this garden and towards the Petite Trianon. I know I'm mispronouncing. Is it Petit? It's probably Petite. Yeah. So while walking out, Charlotte notices there's a lady that is sitting on the grass and she's sketching in a little book, notebook.
Like, thank God, a woman.
And as they cross this bridge, so to get out of the garden and get to the direction that this man, dark-eyed man, was pointing to them, they had to cross this little like archway bridge, mm-hmm. right? And this is very important to remember. So they cross this bridge and to reach the front of the palace. And while they're walking on this bridge, that lady that was sketching in the grass turns and looks at them. And she had a light summer dress on. She had a white hat. She had very light hair. And at first, Charlotte thought, oh, my God, that's a tourist. How does she just get to sit there and sketch with privacy? And like, you know, like that's a little weird. But then they realized that like, wait, that doesn't look right. Like her dress is really old fashioned, like 200 years ago, old fashioned.
Right.
So she puts two and two together after they returned to the palace. And they just, once they got back to the palace, they were able to just rejoin their tour. Like Thank now God. They're at the Palace of Versailles, even though they tried to ditch the tour. But now they're back to the tour, like no time had passed. So they rejoin their tour. And while walking through the palace, they see this picture of Marie Antoinette.
No.
And it was the exact same lady that Charlotte saw in the garden.
Shut up.
So now she's like, what the fuck? Like, we need to get out of this tour because something just happened that we just saw Marie Antoinette. And obviously it was very guarded.
Yeah.
Because people aren't there. So that doesn't give me.
And BEKs that, are blocking it.
That doesn't give me ghost vibes or an apparition vibes. That gives me like, we just fucking went
time
back in
traveled.
Time.
Yeah.
We just time slipped like way back. And so she's like, we need to finish this tour. We need to go get something to eat and we need to go back to your apartment.
We for sure need to go grab a bottle of wine.
And that's exactly what they do. They finish their tour and they go get some food at, they had the restaurant name. I didn't write it down because I would never be able to pronounce it. And some cocktails. And then they return back to Eleanor's apartment.
Got it.
After this tour, the two of them didn't mention the incident to one another until a week after leaving Versailles.
Okay.
Charlotte was writing a letter to her sister about their trip, and she started writing about the afternoon of the Versailles incident. And she kind of stops what she's doing and she finds Eleanor and she asks Eleanor if, hey, do you think that the Petite Trianon is haunted or anything? Like, did you get that vibe? Like, was that haunted or what? And Eleanor was like, for sure, dude. What was that? Like, what
I've been
happened
waiting for
to
you
us?
To bring
like,
that up.
Thank God you. I thought I was going crazy.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 3 months later back in Oxford. So like that was just like a quick conversation. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until 3 months later when they were back in Oxford being co-queens.
Yeah.
What's it called? Principal and VP.
Yeah.
That they would start comparing their notes, and they decided to write two separate accounts of what happened while also starting to research the history of the Trianon, Grand and Petit, and the gardens and the palace and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back to the gardens again numerous times to try to retrace their steps. But they were unable to trace the path that they had originally took.
Oh, my God.
Like, they couldn't find that alleyway that they were in. They couldn't find that cottage, that farmhouse. And the bridge that they were walking on where they saw Marie Antoinette was non-existent.
Shut up.
And they said that anytime they went to the palace or the Trianon, the gardens were just filled with crowds of tourists. But when they were there, there was one woman in there sketching in her own privacy with two men pointing everyone else out.
Yeah.
So, like, this was not...
And there's no little bridge.
And there was no fucking bridge. So they tried to come up with an explanation to how this could have happened. Maybe they were thinking, maybe they walked across a private party, or maybe they were at like a possible like remake event.
Mm-hmm.
But they researched and they researched, and they found that nothing was even booked that afternoon. It was just a regular day, regular tourist day, tourist trap, you know, pay your tickets, get in, do your tour and get out. But through their research, they thought that this is their conclusion of what they walked upon, that they saw, or time slipped, or something happened that they were visibly able to see the events that took place on August 10th, 1792. And again, they went on August 10th.
Yeah.
So this was, I didn't do the exact math, but about 200 year difference.
Right.
Or 110 year difference. August 10th, 1792. And this was only 6 weeks before the abolition of the French monarchy, when the Tuileries Palace in Paris was besieged and the king's Swiss guards were all massacred. So this was like a huge
piece in history.
Huge piece of history.
Yeah.
And they thought that they recognized the man that they reportedly saw by the gardens, the black curly hair, the BEK by the gardens, as a man that's very prominent in history because he was a very good friend of Marie Antoinette. And his name was Comte de Vaudreuil. I'm sorry. Anyway, so he was a good friend of Marie Antoinette. So he's documented in history. And when they came across a sketch of him, they were like, holy fucking shit. That's the guy that pointed us away. That was her guard. That was her security man.
Whoa.
So at this point, they were convinced that the grounds were haunted. They haven't really came to the conclusion that they time slipped, but that more so they saw a piece of time, like a ghost haunt. What's it called?
Like an apparition, like a residual
haunting of like an event that probably was Marie Antoinette's like the last good peaceful memory.
Yeah,
peaceful memory. So the two published a book together called An Adventure, and they published this with pseudonyms of Elizabeth Morrison and Frances Lamont.
I love that they were like, we're too iconic to get some men to discredit us based on this crazy event. So we're going to pick pseudonyms.
The men immediately do discredit them. I'll get to that.
Of course they fucking do. Jesus.
And this book, seeing Marie Antoinette spotted in 1901, it caused a fucking sensation.
Yeah, fucking did.
Everybody wanted to go to the Palace of Versailles. Everyone wanted to experience what they experienced. Mm-hmm. But no one obviously ever
I think
did.
We should go. I feel like they are kind of like us.
I feel like we are the reincarnation.
We should go back. I wonder if we could see it.
So their identity was not made public until 1931. But this wasn't the only instance that this happened. And because they lost a lot of their credibility to their story, because what I'm about to tell you pushed a lot of people to be skeptics of their experience with Marie Antoinette.
Okay.
So in 1914, 13 years after the Marie Antoinette incident, Charlotte claimed to have been in the Louvre. And while there, she saw an apparition of the Roman Emperor Constantine, who was extremely tall, like unusual height, wearing a gold crown and a toga.
Okay.
And during World War I, Eleanor became absolutely convinced that there was a German spy hiding out in their college. And this caused her to become increasingly erratic. And then she dies suddenly in 1924 in the middle of this giant, like, academic scandal that was the scandal being about Eleanor's leadership of the college. So something happened, and no one knows. I couldn't find it, at least, that this causes giant scandal, all while Eleanor is like erratic and is like, there's a German spy here.
Mm-hmm.
And they were about to remove her from VP, and then she just dies suddenly, which me feels like Charlotte. I don't know. Like, the two of them also, because Eleanor was the more like vocal friend mm-hmm. out of the two. Like, she was the more like pushing for the story, mm-hmm. pushing for the book, pushing for
me.
Yeah, she Eleanor was Taylor. Yes. And but Eleanor, remember, was VP.
Yeah.
And Charlotte was president.
Yeah.
So I feel like Charlotte was like, you need to get the fuck out.
Yeah,
of
Charlotte's
here.
Like, shut your fucking mouth. Yeah, you can't talk about this.
She might have, because she died suddenly.
Yeah.
During a big scandal.
And that would look bad on
Charlotte.
Charlotte.
Yeah. So, and then Charlotte also died in 1937. Her cause of death was unknown. But I want to talk about a little bit of the skepticism. Uh-huh. So many people believe that they had just came across one of French poets. His name is Robert de Montesquieu. I've heard of him.
Yeah, I have too.
And yeah. One of his famous parties. So he was known to throw these large, lavish parties in the grounds of like numerous, like very royal places. Mm-hmm. And specifically, he lived very close to the Palace of Versailles. And he was known for his parties on the grounds there, where his friends and his guests would come dressed up in period costumes and would perform like time period acts, like a reenacted party.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of people think that maybe they just came across like this dressed up reenacted party of Marie Antoinette. And
yeah.
They were like, what the fuck? Like maybe da, 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 da. And then also Brian Dunning of Skeptoid believes that this was just like a human mistake. Like the two just didn't get their story right. And he found that during publishing, there was a lot of inconsistencies. And every time they tried to like bring it back to the editorial team, like everything was changing. Like, the story was changing numerous times. And he thinks that between the girls, like just sharing notes and researching together and writing a book, it just got a little out of hand and like maybe a little dramatized and so much untruthful. But then there was also this guy, I didn't write this one down, but I'm going to talk about it because men really do try to discredit women, especially in the 1900s. And he was like, they were lesbians and the lesbianism made them sick and crazy. And they came up with the story because they have lesbianism. I need to find this guy's name, actually.
They have lesbianism?
What yeah, this was fuck? This is just a side effect of lesbianism and crazy women crazy stories.
A side effect of lesbianism.
Yeah.
God, could you imagine me and you back in then?
They'd be like,
for sure lesbianism.
For sure those girls are crazy and that's just a side effect of lesbianism. But anyway, that is the time travel story of two besties who went and visited Marie Antoinette. And I do believe them because of how educated they were.
Yeah.
And also because they wrote under pseudonym, so they weren't trying to get any sort of fame. And also because I have heard read that Marie Antoinette is one of those apparitions that comes forward a lot.
A lot. I have too.
Like a lot of people have seen her and maybe they did fucking time slip, dude. Like
I feel like they time slipped.
I think so too.
I think the date is really interesting. And
Speaking of the bridge, one of the skeptical people, probably the lesbian guy, was like, 1903, just found a historic map where the bridge is. I didn't include it because it didn't say if it was a map from 1903 because it said historical map. So like, yeah, you could have found a map in the year 1903, but the map was from 1790. I didn't include it, but it was probably the same lesbianism guy.
Yeah, just trying his best to do anything he can. Yeah,
because
he wants their jobs. Jesus Christ. Yeah, that's crazy. That's wild. I really do believe that they time slipped. I think that they did too. And I think that it drove them a little like crazy and made them very paranoid, because if me and you time slipped and saw something in history that was like so big and we knew we couldn't talk about it because we would get our entire careers and life and credibility stripped from us.
Right.
We would be like, but the men in black are going to come after us.
Right. But like want that story out and
And
have to write under pseudonym, which is what we would do. If we experienced something like that, dude, we would write with fake names.
Yeah, 100%. We definitely would write with fake names.
Because we'd be like, people need to hear this fucking story, but we're going to lose all credibility if our names are attached to that.
Or we'll get sued if we do it. So it's just like, you know.
Right. Right. And fake names.
Yeah. Right.
Fake just names. Just crazy. Anyway, that's all I got. Cool little case.
Yeah, that's a crazy cool. I want to go there now. And I feel like me and you might be able to time slip.
I think so, too.
What if we time slipped and we were behind them walking?
Ew, I'm tripping out. I have chills.
I'm tripping dicks.
I have chills.
Oh, my God. That would be crazy. I would be like, ladies, pull your shit together.
Listen, this is what's going to happen
when
to you.
When you go back.
Yes, this is real. We are from the year 2023.
They're going to be like, what? Y'all are still alive? They're gonna be like, what the fuck?
First off, we would not be able to understand
each other.
What are
you wearing? We'd be like in crop tops, leather, my leather trench coat.
Fred Morgan's leather trench coat. They're like, are you
pointed
guys
pointed black boots? They're like, did you guys come to kill us?
Yeah, and they see my acne and they're like, it's smallpox. It's smallpox. I'm like, no, I'm just purging.
No, whoa, that's crazy. Yeah. God, I hate that. But that would, you know, that would drive someone crazy. And
yeah, for sure.
And I, you know, I'm a firm believer too that like once you open yourself up to like whether it's spiritual or time slipping or anything, or like once you experience it, like you are more susceptible to experience it again because you're looking for it. And right. I think that in everyday life, there's probably more instances like that than we think.
And maybe that's why they saw what they saw afterwards, like at right. the Louvre and the right. World War I thing.
I mean, it's like if, you know, you're looking to buy a new car and you're looking to buy a fucking a red F-150. What are you going to see on the road every single day?
Every second of the day.
Red F-150.
Yep.
That's what you're going to, I don't know why. There's just a red F-150 at my neighbor's house. That's why I said that. So I'm not.
Big truck girl over here.
Big truck.
Built to last.
Yeah. Yeah. No, like, I, you know, you see it more often because you're able to, like, your brain's subconsciously right. constantly looking
That's
for
like when
it.
when I bought my car, I'm sure the same with you. You yep. saw them everywhere.
Everywhere. And then it pisses me off.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, shit.
Not even
everyone's
I'm
got
not
this
even
fucking
unique.
Car. It drives me crazy. I'm like, I'm gonna walk into the parking lot and accidentally get in the wrong car.
Ford, built to last.
I'm like a Ford girl now. Ford, if you want to sponsor us, go ahead. All right. So the case I have for you guys today, this is a mind blowing case.
Oh shit.
Mainly because I've never heard of it, but I feel like I have, and it's considered to be one of the. And I don't know exactly like what the terms are. It's not the oldest unsolved case in America by any means. On my mini on Patreon, that I don't know when the hell that comes out in comparison to this one, but for November. But
soon, actually, around this.
Yeah, if not like already released, then about to be. Many cases say like this is the oldest unsolved case in America or in the city and in the state. And da, 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 da. But there's different variations that like heavily reported on, most sensationalized of a young child, you know, with no leads, with no suspects. Da, 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 da. So there's like many different variations of that. But I think what is so big about this one is that the amount of people that it reached and the popularity that it had. And you'll understand that when we get into it. So this is the case of Maria Ridolph is how I believe the pronunciation is. I've listened to like a few different reporters and I feel like they all say it a little differently. So Maria Ridolph is what I'm going to go with. We're in Sycamore, Illinois on March 12th, 1950. Maria Elizabeth is born to Michael and Francis, and she is the youngest of their four children. They have three girls now and one boy. Michael, her father, worked at one of the few factories in the area, which was a really big deal because this was mainly a farming area. So that was a good job. Mm-hmm. And because of this, Francis was able to be a homemaker. On December 3rd, 1957, seven-year-old Maria begs to go and play outside in the snow after dinner. So her and her best friend had been playing outside. That's also her neighbor. They got called in at 5 p.m. to eat dinner.
Yeah, eat dinner.
And they were like,
over.
As soon as you're done with dinner, we're going to go outside because it's about to snow.
Right.
So Maria's like pounding her dinner and she's like, all right, mom, I'm done. I lick my plate clean. I put it in the sink. I'm ready to go.
And the dog did not touch it.
The dog did not touch it. The garbage can never heard of her. I ate the whole thing. We got to go though. Her mom's like, okay, put on your jacket, put on your, you know, hood and everything. Go outside. It's cold, mind you. We're in Illinois.
And probably starting to get dark, if not dark already.
In December, right. So it's getting dark, if not dark already. She's like, all right, go outside. And meanwhile, both of her parents are home and so are all of her siblings. Maria sprints outside to her best friend's house, who is eight-year-old Kathy Sigmund, knocks on the door and is like, are you done with dinner yet? You ready to go? And she's like, yeah, let's go.
Let's ride.
Let's ride, bitch. And they went outside to go play their favorite game, which was called ducking the cars or duck the cars, which means that they would run across their street. This is very dangerous. Don't ever play this game. They would run back and forth, like zigzagging across the street. And whoever had headlights from an oncoming car, like land on them, lost.
Very, wow, girls.
Very, very
innovative. Sounds like something my sister or brother would make up and force me to play.
Exactly. So they're playing this game. It was their favorite car, their favorite game to play. And in the middle of this, according to Kathy, a man comes up to them. And according to Kathy and CNN reportings, the man says, quote, hello, little girls. Are you having fun? Ew, fucking creep.
Gross. Now, she described him to be young, in his early 20s, tall, longer, like blonde hair, a gap in his teeth, colorful sweater, and like a sharp, thin chin. He introduces himself to the little girls as Johnny. He says he's 24 years old and he's not married. And then he asks, do you little girls like piggyback rides and dollies?
Oh my God.
Fuck. Maria is like, yeah. And Kathy's like, hell yeah. We like all the things. Yeah. What are you talking about? He's like, well, where are your dollies? Why aren't you playing with your dollies? And so Maria's like, mine's inside. And he's like, well, where do you live? And she's like, two houses down. And he says, okay, Kathy, you wait here. I'm going to take Maria to her house to pick up her dolly, and then I'll come back and I'll take you to get your dolly. Kathy's like, okay. So she stands on the sidewalk. Maria jumps on this guy's back, Johnny's back, and he takes her to her house. She jumps off. She runs inside. Her dad's watching a Western in the living room. Her mom's reading the newspaper. Her brother's upstairs listening to records with his friends. Her older sisters are hanging around the house. She sprints inside the living room in front of her dad, grabs this like doll. It's her favorite doll out of this pile. It's in the floor and is about to run back outside. And either one of the parents says to her, hey, it's snowing. You should probably take your plastic doll instead of your cloth doll outside. Right. But she didn't say like what was going on. She just ran inside to grab her doll and was running back outside. And so, you know, they're thinking, Jesus Christ, her and Kathy are about to have a whole dollhouse made out of snow, sticks and snow and outside. Igloo. Right. So she runs inside. She grabs her doll. She runs back outside. She jumps back on Johnny's back and he gives her a piggyback ride back to where Kathy is. Puts her down. And Maria and Kathy are sitting there talking to this guy, showing off Maria's doll. And Kathy's getting really, really cold when they were away. Like, she's realizing how cold she actually was from, you know, she's hot. They're running back and forth, dodging
now
cars.
She's standing there.
Now she's just standing there. She's getting really cold. So she's like, I need to go get my mittens. And she says, Maria, come inside with me. We'll get my dolly and my mittens together. And Maria says, no, I don't want to go in. I'll wait here with Johnny. Well, when Kathy comes back outside, Maria and the man are gone. She thinks that they're playing duck the cars without her. So she starts running around alongside the cars and along the street, looking for them, yelling for them. She doesn't hear them. She looks in their normal playing spots. She can't find them anywhere. So then she goes to Maria's house, knocks on the door and says, did Maria come inside? And her family is like, no, she just came inside to get the doll and ran back outside to play with you. What are you talking about? And they're like, I can't find her. According to CNN, her parents send out, and I'm going to continue saying CNN. I think I'm probably going to stop saying it right now because it's my main source for the majority of this. And it's because there was a three chapters of articles that were written and very, very, very well researched. Great source for this. So that's what I'm referring to. Her family says to her older brother, Chuck, and his friend, Randy, who were upstairs listening to records, go outside and look for your sister. They come downstairs. You know, they're pissed that they're having to go out here and stop their record time to go find Maria. And they're looking around for her. They're walking all around. Like, they walked like blocks away and they cannot find her.
No.
So they run back to the parents' house and they're like, we cannot find her. I don't know exactly what the process was, but I do know that there were multiple calls between Kathy's mom, Flora, and Frances, Maria's mom, being like, what was the last thing that Maria did when Kathy was with her? Because one thing that everyone knew is that Maria was very scared of the dark and it was getting dark and she would never be by herself outside.
Right.
Basically, through these like multiple phone calls, they find out about Johnny.
Shit.
And
that has to make your fucking stomach drop.
Immediately. After realizing there's a Johnny involved, that she's not in any of her places. This is about an hour of these conversations because, you know, Kathy's not thinking, she's 8 years old. She's not thinking much of this.
Right.
This is when they realize, like, this is not a game. She's not hiding. We need to call police. And you can't, it's 1957. You can't call police. You have to like drive to the police station.
Right.
So, well, at least they did. I guess the area that they lived in. Within the hour, sources differ on this, but the majority of them confirm that around 8:15 is when full police search party along with armed citizens gather at the home to begin searching the entire town for Maria and this Johnny. They cannot find anything. Not a piece of clothing, not the dolly. And you have to remember, it's cold outside. So she was, you know, had her beanie on, her mittens, a scarf, you know, a big jacket, all these different things, and a doll. Like, if she was abducted, something's dropped, something's fallen.
Right.
This is really concerning. So the FBI gets called in because the only thing that they can rationalize is that she was abducted, put into a car, and driven across state lines. FBI officially arrives in Sycamore 2 days later to like be in person with a full squad to assist local and state law enforcement. Investigators from all of these offices conduct interviews. Many witnesses saw the girls playing outside alone from 6 to 6:30 p.m. And they compare witness timelines, including family from the time that she came in to get the doll and Kathy went in to get the mittens, to try and figure out exactly what time Johnny came up and when Maria disappeared. Mm-hmm. And basically, the FBI concludes that based on the knowledge that they have right at that moment, she was likely abducted between 6:45 p.m. and 7 p.m. Kathy Sigmund was immediately placed in protective custody, fearing that her kidnapper would come back to hunt her down and kill her only person that saw his full face and had all this information about him. And they show her many lineups of convicted felons to try and find Johnny or just get like a more clear
idea of picture what he could look like.
Of what he looks like. Like, does his hair look like this? Does his eyes look like this? You know, so on and so forth. And in late December of 1957, Kathy is taken to the Dane County Sheriff's Office in Madison, Wisconsin, where she's shown another lineup. During this lineup, Kathy positively identifies a man named Thomas Joseph Rivard as Johnny. He was a 35-year-old man, 5'4", 156 pounds, with dark blonde, longer wavy hair. However, he had an alibi. And when I mean an alibi, I mean like he was in jail. So it wasn't him. But Kathy later argues that she does not believe she identified him. She says he kind of looks like him, but like that's not him. She was just trying to do the comparison situation.
Right.
This is late December by the time that this lineup happens. There's no discoveries. There are no leads. And the case is going cold very fast. They needed the public help. This case shocks America. They start doing massive media pushes to try and get any information that they can. And again, they are thinking that she was taken across state lines. So they are trying to get this to a national audience. I'm talking national radio, TV, newspapers, magazines, take this case, take interviews with the parents and investigators and plead for Maria's safe return. And this catches the eyes and breaks the heart of some of the top U.S. political officials, including President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who gets involved with the case and speaks on it. Even the director of the FBI at the time, which was J. Edgar Hoover, is like involved in this case.
We and know sending, that name.
Sending his top dogs out here. Exactly. Yeah. But it doesn't matter because no matter how much attention that this case got, there was nothing that was viable coming out of any of the leads that they were getting. So fast forward to April 26, 1958. This is just months later. In Woodbine, Illinois, two tourists are mushroom hunting along U.S. Route 20, and they come across the skeletal remains of a small child partially hidden under a fallen tree. The remains only were wearing socks, underwear, and a shirt. Using dental records, they confirmed that it was Maria, as well as her shirt, because it was a shirt she was wearing that day, and a lock of her hair. Coroner James Furlong refused to take photos of the body at the scene because of how big this case had gotten. He knew that someone would leak the child's body to the media, and he did not want that to happen at all. So he refused to let anyone near it with a camera.
Wow. Good for him.
An autopsy was performed. However, they could not determine a cause of death due to the state of decomposition. And remember, this is 1958. There's not a lot of technology for this. But with this, even more pressure to solve the case due to public attention and the popularity is put on investigators.
For sure.
But now, knowing that her body was discovered within state lines, the FBI is withdrawn from this investigation. Local and state law enforcement take over the case once again. I'm going to get into this for a second, but like, I think the FBI lingered a little bit longer to try and like make sure that local and state law enforcement were on the right path. But they also did a ton of work while they were there. So it kind of gets confusing with the timeline. Again, this is a very old case that's been heavily reported on over the years. So there's just so many different avenues that this right. can go. Anyways, we'll get back into that. So the FBI withdraws himself from the investigation due to the fact that it wasn't over state lines. So local and state law enforcement take over once again. Now, the first thing that they do is they start reviewing all of the information from the interviews that were conducted by the FBI, by other law enforcement agencies, state and local, you know, different departments, just trying to get a clear picture of exactly what was going on at this point in time in the neighborhood. And Frances, Maria's mother, is adamant that her daughter had to have known her kidnapper because, quote, she was a nervous girl who would become hysterical when in trouble and could only be calmed down by me. Quote, she was a screamer, very afraid of the dark. So that does indicate, like,
yeah. And for them to so, like, easily just jump on their back. Like, I do know they're little girls and you aren't taught of stranger danger during this time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? But, like, also.
But, like, if she thought she was going to get in trouble, which I think any kid at that time, no matter the time frame it is, you know, you're thinking, like, my parents told me I got to be back before dark. It's getting kind of dark. I'm going to get kind of freaking out. Right? Yeah. My son, you're back. Johnny.
Or I'm not leaving without Kathy.
Yeah. Like, I want to wait on Kathy. Yeah, exactly. So the FBI prior to leaving thought the same thing. And they also noted that Johnny was likely the true nickname of this kidnapper. They probably lived around the area and likely had watched Maria and Kathy knew that they were going to be out there. Maybe he was watching them playing before dinner and had probably made very minimal, not intimate or like intense contact with them prior, but likely showed their face to Maria at some point in time.
And clearly Maria was his targeted victim.
Exactly. Because why would he...
If you can get both, why wouldn't it?
Right.
That sounds sick and twisted.
It does.
But in their mind.
He walks up and he offers Maria the piggyback ride. Like, that is weird. And, you know, Kathy's like, well, I got to go inside and get my fucking men's. Are you going to take me there?
Yeah, where's my piggyback ride?
Right, you know. Now, the FBI starts looking closer to Maria's home for a young, tall man with the name John, Jonathan, Johnny, so on and so forth. And investigators landed on a young man in the neighborhood, living just under two blocks away from Maria's house. And he was an 18-year-old guy living at home with his parents. And his name was John Tessier. It's T-E-S-S-I-E-R. Tessier, I believe. Okay. Again, this gets really confusing because I'm going to try to give you a concise altogether timeline of the investigation into him. But what you need to know is that it was very different from the timeline I'm going to give you. But if I gave you the original timeline, it just wouldn't make sense if I broke it apart. So local law enforcement did like a quick questioning on the night. Like, they went door to door in Maria's neighborhood when she went missing on the night of the 3rd and the morning of the 4th looking. And they had contact with him and his family. Then the FBI agents performed a formal interview with parents and John between December 4th and December 8th. And then an FBI formal interrogation was performed on December 8th and a polygraph was administered on December 10th. And then local/state law enforcement interviewed the family once again after the body was discovered. So I'm throwing all of these different instances all into one section for the sake of clarity. Okay, so let's first talk about John Tessier. He was born John Cherry on November 27th, 1939 in Belfast, Northern Ireland. His parents were Samuel Cherry, who was a British sergeant, and Eileen McCullough Cherry. Unfortunately, his father, Samuel, was killed very early on in action of World War II, and his mother, Eileen, served as one of the first female airplane spotters with the UK Royal Air Force.
Wow.
Now, during her time working with the Royal Air Force, she meets Ralph Tessier, and he was in the U.S. 8th Army Air Force Regiment, I guess, I don't know, in England, and they got married in November of 1944 when John was only 7. After World War II and their marriage, John and Eileen moved to the U.S. with Ralph to Sycamore, Illinois. John begins going by his stepfather's name, Tessier. Ralph and Eileen had 6 additional children together. Ralph owned a hardware store and was a painter. They were very good people within their community. They had a big family, and he painted signs like for businesses, but he also painted the Sycamore police cars in the area.
So they knew him.
Yeah. And he was very close with the police chief because of this, because he fixed all their cars. John, as a child, was described to be very quiet and shy at first, not too great at school. And he really struggled with the move from Northern Ireland to the U.S., but also because he lost his dad and he was 7. It's a lot. So he struggled with these life changes and began acting out a little while after getting to the U.S. Like, an example of this was that he got expelled in the 10th grade because he pushed a teacher and began cursing at her, calling her names. And he decided after high school that he was going to join the U.S. Air Force. So in 1957, like I said, he's 18 years old. He's living at home just two blocks away, if that, from Maria's house. On December 4th, 1957, the day after the kidnapping, local investigators visited the Tessier home. And Eileen told police that John had been home with her the entire night before. So they're like, all right, cool. Thank you. Moving on to the next house. Because they're just being like, hey, was everyone in your house last night? Do you know of a little girl? Did you see her? Nope. Thanks. Great. Write your name down. Moving on. So then after the discovery of the remains in April of 1958, investigators go back to the Tessier home for a formal interview. And I'm not sure what exactly triggered them to bring him back into this, bring that house back into this, but they just start zeroing in on him. Some sources say that it was from a tip that was sent in by a member of the public, like a random person. But other people say that it was actually John's parents trying to clear their son's name.
Yeah, I figured you were
because his nickname was Johnny.
Yeah.
And they were like, it doesn't look good that we're two blocks away and your name's fucking Johnny, but you know, we should just get them to clear you and we'll be good. First, before they could go back and like intensely interview him after the discovery of the remains, they needed to go through all of the interviews that local, state, and FBI law enforcement officers had with John and his family over the course of this investigation and re-examine all of this. And during this, they find so many inconsistencies after merging them all together for clarity. Number one, Eileen, like I just said, first told the officers that John had been home all night with her. But when the FBI came by between the 4th and the 8th, she tells the FBI agents that were at her house the following story that I'm about to walk us through. This was like the biggest thing that they were like, we need to go back there. Maybe John, I don't know if he was there or if it was just his parents. I do know that he was there when FBI came in, but I don't believe he was there after the discoveries of the remains when the local law enforcement came back in. So this is what the family tells the FBI originally and local and state law enforcement when they come back after the discovery of the remains. They say that on December 2nd, 1957, John went to Chicago. He had to go there to get his physical and psychological military exams done. And then on December 3rd, he like woke up in the morning, does a lot of sightseeing in Chicago, and then he jumps on a train sometime around 5 p.m. and goes to Rockford, Illinois. Now, this is 40 miles away from Sycamore, and he arrives in Rockford at 6:45 p.m. The first thing that he does is go to the Rockford post office and calls his parents to let them know that he had arrived there because he needed a ride and he had left his car at home. And this call came through. It was confirmed by records of the operator and like the collect call that he made this phone call at 6:57 p.m. After making this call at the post office, he walks to the Rockford recruiting station, military recruiting station, drops off some paperwork that he needed to leave for his enlistment to the Air Force, and officers at the recruiting office confirmed this 7:15 p.m. drop off. And they like maybe talked for 20, 30 minutes. But the reason they remember it so clearly is because they closed at 7 p.m. So they were fucking pissed.
Yeah, for that sure. This,
like, first off, dude, you're enlisting in the military and you're already fucking late. Like, you're not going to do good in the military, bro.
Right.
So they were annoyed. But the main reason that he needed to come by was because he needed to point out to them that a doctor during his physical exam, like an X-ray or an MRI or something, came across a spot on his lung that needed to be examined by someone at the recruiting center. So he leaves sometime around 7:30, I believe. His parents pick him up, specifically his dad, and drives him back to Sycamore. Now, on December 4th, so that's the day that Maria was abducted, and they said that Ralph went to go pick him up at around 8 p.m. On December 4th, 1957, the day after she was abducted, that morning, John wakes up and he drives his car to Rockford to go back to the recruiting office to have the conversation that he needs to have about the
MRI
situation. And he has an interview there with one officer and then he leaves. So the FBI investigators, when they were doing their investigation sometime between December 4th and December 8th, go to that recruiting office and interview the officers that worked with him on the night of the 3rd and worked with him on the morning of the 4th. And the two officers from the 3rd said, first off, they were pissed that he was late. Like, they were like, we are questioning his credibility and his conduct. Like, he was late on his first thing that he had to do for the military. Not a good look. But they felt that he was, quote, very nervous, and this made them suspect that he was a possible drug addict. So they wanted that to be looked into. They like made a note on his file about it. They also said, quote, he seemed like a lost sheep, panicked, weird. So then they go and find the one recruiter that he had the meeting with on the morning of December 4th. And this was Staff Sergeant John Oswald. He noted that when John arrived, he had a fresh, bloody cut on his lip. When they're like preparing to have this little meeting or interview, also they're making small talk, and only thing Oswald is looking at is like his demeanor, because they're trying to see if he's fit to join the military.
Right.
So he's really zeroing in everything about this kid. And one of the things that like caught his eye was that lip injury. But then in this small talk, John says, quote, "Good thing I was here last night and not in Sycamore, because a little girl disappeared."
What?
Unwarranted. What? And then he even goes on to say something along the lines of, "Yeah, I'm not a suspect and I won't be, because, you know, my girlfriend's dad is deputy sheriff. So we're good." And then it gets worse. He pulls out what he calls his, quote, "little black book" and shows this to Oswald, flipping through the pages. And inside there were names and addresses of random girls in Sycamore, along with their bust and hip measurements.
What the fuck?
What the fuck?
What the fuck?
Yeah. So investigators are like, oh, not, this is not it. This is not good. This is our guy.
Yeah.
So the FBI is like, great, you're going to come in for a lie detector test and a formal interrogation. I believe that the formal interrogation took place on the 8th. They asked in his like lie detector, like during his polygraph, one of the things that they asked him was if he had ever had sex with a child. And he says, yes, quote, "I was involved in some sex play with a younger girl years ago," end quote, but said he outgrew it.
And they weren't like,
what the fuck? And then he said that he had no relationship at all with Maria. He did say like he knew her from the neighborhood, but he had never spoken to her, like they didn't have a relationship. And he passed this polygraph like with flying colors.
But the whole child sex thing, we don't think we need to.
Is no one concerned about that? Because I'm very fucking concerned.
Yeah.
Anyways, on December 10th is when the polygraph took place. And after the polygraph, the FBI had this analyzed and they confirmed that he was no longer a suspect, noting, quote, "no further investigation is being conducted regarding the above suspect," and marked him off the list. Yet in all of the lineups shown to Kathy, not a single one included a photo of John. So on December 11th, 1957, the day after getting cleared and getting this polygraph test, John leaves Sycamore and never returns. He reports to basic training at Lackland Air Force Base and never comes back to Sycamore.
Wait, they let him in after those interviews?
Yep, they let him in.
They must have been fucking desperate.
They must have been desperate. Well, the FBI might have been convinced, and I guess the fucking military was like, sure, that's fine. But local and state law enforcement are not good. They're like, this is, how the fuck did this get past anybody? So they don't believe that he stayed in Chicago all day. They do not believe that for one second. They believe that he likely returned to Sycamore and that the lie detector test, he was telling the truth, but it was because the proper questions were not being asked. Did he have a relationship with Maria? No. But did you talk to Maria on the night of December 3rd would have been a more appropriate question. Basically comparing the notes that they had where Eileen, his mom, said that she was with him all night compared to, oh, he was actually being picked up in Rockford 40 miles away by his dad. She lied to police and told FBI versus local law enforcement something very different stories. And then also the FBI agents noted that Eileen, his mom, came to the station with him the day that he got his lie detector test, and she was like sobbing, throwing up, having a panic attack the entire time, so much so that agents had to go out there and like console her and be like, this is just standard, it's okay, it's fine, calm down.
What the fuck?
Right. And they kind of wrote it off to being like, maybe it's like a cultural thing that's just different, because she's from Northern Ireland originally. So they were like, maybe she just like never thought that she'd have maybe never been involved with American law enforcement. Yeah. But like, what? John also says that Ralph picked him up at 8 in Rockford, and Ralph confirmed this. Now, they don't think that lines up actually, and we're going to come back to this, but initially investigators were like, something's off about this timeline. Unfortunately, other than just re-interviewing the parents, that is all that they could do, because there's not enough evidence to support an arrest for John. There's not enough evidence to go pull his ass out of basic training.
Right.
And bro's long gone. So the case goes cold. For years, this case sat cold, but still active within local and state law enforcement because they're just constantly passing it around, just hoping that someone's like, someone will see something different in it. But it just never happens. And this gets a lot of criticism for the law enforcement agencies because of the way that they handle it and the way that it was just kind of like so sporadic and all over the place. Now, granted, they did have a few other suspects, one main one being a guy named William Henry Redmond. In 1997, Sycamore Police Lieutenant at the time, Patrick Soler, identified Redmond 40 years later, saying that he was more than likely the person that abducted and killed Maria. Redmond was a former truck driver and carnival worker from Nebraska who actually died in 1992. But in 1988, he was charged with the 1951 murder of an 8-year-old girl from Pennsylvania. And the case was dismissed due to the prosecution, the main law enforcement officer that was working the case, investigating the case, refusing to release the identity of a confidential informant in court, which I think should be illegal for a case to be thrown out for that.
Yeah, fuck like that.
If the informant has to come and have a meeting with the fucking judge, that's fine. But he doesn't need to be on court documents if this is a confidential informant. And a case should never be overthrown because of that or thrown out because of that. But he was also a prime suspect in the 1951 disappearance of 10-year-old Beverly Potts in Ohio with a similar MO. And this is another popular case that I do want to cover soon. He is said to have a similar demeanor as Johnny, like the way that he looked and the way that he talked and the way that he walked. But all of this evidence that this new head of the fucking Sycamore police lieutenant dude had was just circumstantial and it was not credible at all. Like, eventually they were like, you can't say that he's a suspect. Number one, he's dead. And number two, you don't have anything to say. Number three, he's not a credible suspect. That makes no sense.
Right.
Makes no sense. Fast forward to 2008. The case gets reopened by a cold case unit. This was solely based on information from Janet Tessier, who is John's half-sister, one of Eileen and Ralph's children. But before I get into what exactly she said that got this case reopened, I need to tell you about what had gone on in John's life from 1957 when he joined the military.
So 18 on.
Mm-hmm, 18 on. So he serves in the U.S. military for 13 years. He rose in the ranks of captain by the time that he retired. After leaving the military, he moved to Seattle, Washington, where he graduated from King County Law Enforcement Academy in June of 1974. He becomes a police officer in the small town of Lacey, which is near Olympia, and later joins the Milton, Washington Police Department, where he has a falling out with the police chief. Like, these two were just like two fire signs together. It just wasn't good. Like, everyone was like, they always butted heads. And the police chief actually tried to get him fired, but like couldn't. So they made for a lot more drama going on there. But in 1982 in Tacoma, Washington, guys, I'm going to give you a trigger warning for SA and molestation of a minor before I jump into this part. If you need to skip forward, I would say about like just skip 2 minutes. So in 1982, Tacoma, Washington, he's still working for Milton Police Department. And he takes in two 15-year-old runaways, one being Michelle Weinman and then her friend, both who knew John because he was a Milton police officer. And they lived with him for a little while.
And they trusted him because he was law enforcement.
He was a police officer. And shortly after moving in, this is the main trigger warning, he began to fondle Michelle and perform oral sex on her without her consent. Tessier was charged with statutory rape. He pled guilty in a deal to communication with a minor for immoral purposes instead of the statutory rape because this would be a misdemeanor versus a felony.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fucked up.
He was sentenced to 1 year of formal probation.
Wow.
After which he was obviously terminated from Milton Police Department in March 10th, 1982. You know that police chief was like the best day of his fucking life to sign those papers. So on April 27th, 1994, John goes and he legally changes his name to Jack Daniel McCullough to honor his now late mother, Eileen, who passed away in January of 1994. So that's where he's at now at this point in time. Janet, in 2008, gets this case reopened because she goes to police with some information alongside all of her other sisters, but specifically Catherine and Janine were the main ones that were with her. Also, another sister called Mary Pat. Now, the case gets open in 2012. And this, what I'm about to tell you is like the cliff notes of what she said. Long version is going to follow. But this is what caught the investigators' attention to be like, let's fucking talk to her. She sends this email and she says, my mom lied to police. John was not home that night. We all knew it. She told us that she was lying. They have no idea where he actually was. Then my dad, Ralph, lied to police because Catherine says no, because that there's no way he could have picked up John at 8 p.m. in Rockford because Ralph was in DeKalb, which is a town over, picking up and dropping off her for her 4-H meeting that went on from 5 to 8 p.m. Then when they returned home at around 8:15, they drove past like lines and lines and lines of police cars and people getting ready for the search. Before the search started, Ralph, as I said, owned a hardware store, went inside to supply searchers with flashlights for the nighttime search. Therefore, either Ralph was never there to pick up John or picked him up between sometime 5:30 and 7:30, but we have no idea. There's no way that he could have gone and gotten him at 8 p.m.
Yeah, because his daughter's 4-H meeting was over then.
Right, and she remembered this. This is a big day. This is a traumatizing day. Right. Someone in her neighborhood that was around her age got abducted and murdered. That's going to be engraved in her head. The timeline is going to be. What else she says is John was seen by a friend driving around in his car on December 3rd in the afternoon in Sycamore when he was supposed to be in Chicago. He drove this Pontiac that had these hand-painted flames by his dad on the side of it that was so recognizable, and he refused to ever let anyone drive his car ever. It was his baby. Next, there was a deathbed confession.
Mom.
From Eileen. So now you see why they immediately jumped on reopening this case. So I'm going to get into the long version of it. According to Janet, on Eileen's deathbed, she said, quote, "Those two little girls and the one that disappeared, John did it. John did it. And you have to tell somebody," end quote.
Two little girls. Oh, and the one that Kathy disappeared. Okay, yes. I'm like, wait, there's another one. But yeah, Kathy.
Yeah. Another sister, Mary Pat, was also there and she heard the same thing. But the only thing that she could say, like, I heard for sure, was that he did it. John did it. According to Catherine and Janine, also sisters, Eileen lied to investigators about John's whereabouts, and they witnessed multiple conversations behind closed doors between Ralph and Eileen and John discussing this lie and how they were going to keep it up. Also, Janet and Janine testified on record, trigger warning again for molestation, skip forward 30 seconds. John threatened to kill Janet with a gun and sexually molested Janine when she was a minor. Janet said that over the years, she made many attempts to take all this information to police. She went to the FBI. She went to local law enforcement, state law enforcement. No one would listen. And finally, in 2008, she sent this huge, long email to the Illinois State Police tip line. And thus, the cold case unit took on the case and reopened it. Other women came forward claiming John, that around the same time, would often offer piggyback rides. One of these girls remembers accepting, and it was traumatizing for her because John refused to put her down. Like, so much so to the point that her dad had to come outside and fight John to get his daughter off of John's back.
What the fuck?
Using this new timeline, new theories emerge about what exactly went down that night. And Maria, they believe now that Maria would have had to been kidnapped, not between 6:45 and 7 p.m. as the FBI originally concluded, but instead at 6:20 p.m. because her father went to the police station to report her missing after searching on their own for like an hour, sometime between 7:45 and 8 p.m. The reason why he waited so long was because, like, months prior to this, Maria had gone and played in a cemetery and forgot to ask her parents for permission. And they were screaming, looking for her. No one could find her.
She's in trouble.
They organized a search party. And as the search party was in the gathering about to break apart, Maria walked up and was like, "What's going on?" And they were like, "Are you kidding?" Aww. So that's why, like, they waited so long, because they were like, she probably went to the fucking cemetery and didn't tell us where she was going, because she was just like a high energy little girl, you know, like that was her thing. And her and her friend would just go and fuck up those neighborhood streets. They just had the best time ever. So they didn't really think much of it at first. But then when they realized like how serious it was, it got that serious. After the cold case unit reviewed all of this evidence and all of these interviews, they determined that 100% John could have kidnapped Maria at 6:20 p.m. because he likely was not in Chicago that day. He probably drove back.
Mm-hmm.
And that means
and he
that
was spotted.
He was spotted. That means that he could have abducted her at 6:20 p.m., murdered her, driven to Rockford, made that phone call by 6:57 p.m. at that post office. Probably didn't need to be picked up because he had his car. So it was calling something about something different. Thus, his parents formed another lie for him. So this is now the third lie that we can track from his parents. And this all would have made him late, having to stop and make that call to give himself an alibi to the recruiting office, which was a bad look for him to walk in 15 minutes after the fucking place closed, because he wouldn't have done that otherwise. Like, why were you late? You were there. You could have gotten there.
Right. You have no excuse.
You have no excuse. So July 2011, John Tessier, or now Jack, Jack Daniel McCullough. He's in his 70s. He's living in a retirement community in Seattle. He's completely estranged for his family and had been for many, many years. Like, I think since his time in the service, like, he has not had a relationship with them, to the point that he was not invited and told to not come to his own mother's funeral.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. He was in Seattle working as a security
and they
guard.
Harbored that lie for him for so long.
For so long. Even like the parents.
Strange. Yeah.
And it wasn't until after the parents both died that the sisters finally spoke out, which is really good on them. I know that must have been very, very, like, I bet that caused a lot of rift in the family.
For sure.
So because he's living in Seattle and this cold case unit is in Illinois through the state, they have to partner with the Seattle Police Department. And they're like, hell yeah, let's do it. So they immediately partner with them and start the investigation. They bring John in for questioning, but they have to use a professional interrogator because he has been in the military for 13 years and he is trained in all law enforcement tactics because of his time in law enforcement. So they begin the questioning and they're like easing into it. So it's just like, how you doing? Good. You know, what you been up to? How was your time with the duh? You know, I know a buddy yeah. down there at Milton, you know, just classic. And during this conversation, he's super relaxed. His shoulders are down. He's collected. He's calm. He's cool. He's cooperative. He's having like lots of conversation, being very open about stuff. But then the interrogator brings up Maria and questions his alibi. Immediately, the second Maria gets brought up into this, he becomes enraged, aggressive, evasive, and just like his body language is very visibly upset and angry. He refuses to answer any more questions. So they're like, okay, that's cool. We're going to arrest you for the kidnapping and murder of 7-year-old Maria in Sycamore, Illinois, 1957. You're arrested. And they extradite him immediately to Illinois.
Damn.
Maria's body is then exhumed within days of the arrest, and they're looking for any sort of DNA evidence that they could possibly find. So they re-examine, do a new autopsy with current day technology. Unfortunately, they were unable to find any DNA evidence. However, a forensic anthropologist discovered her cause of death. Maria had been stabbed in the throat at least 3 times with a long, sharp blade. It had hit her sternum. This is how they determined it. It had hit her sternum and her neck vertebrae in a way that is consistent with, quote, at least 3 slashes to her throat. Also, evidence on the remaining soft tissue suggests ligature strangulation. However, there's nothing because they don't have evidence, and it's just they end up saying that her cause of death was stabbing instead of strangulation. It could have been either or. They then go to Kathy, her friend, who is 8 years old all these years later, and they show her a lineup. And this time, a picture of John from 1957 is in it. She immediately identified him as Johnny.
Wow.
He was formally charged with kidnapping and murdering Maria 54 years later. So he goes to trial in 2012 and he's being held in jail this entire time, right? And an inmate testifies that John said, quote, he didn't plan on killing her, but she wouldn't stop screaming, which aligns with what her mother said, that she was a screamer, very loud, wow, and would get hysterical and couldn't be calmed down.
I have heard this before.
Yeah. I see, like, this is the part that I felt like I knew. And he said that he was trying to cover her mouth to make her stop. She passes out. She fights him. He kills her. And it was more so an accident. It was supposed to be just an abduction, not a murder.
But what were his intentions, though?
To molest her. Yeah. Probably to molest her, because that seems to be every other thing that has happened. He's mm-hmm. never killed, but
yeah,
you know.
So he had guilt, which would then yeah. fuel that anger, rage anytime it comes up.
Yep, exactly. On September 14th, 2012, 73-year-old Jack Daniel McCullough, or John Tessier, is convicted of kidnapping and murdering Maria and sentenced to life in prison with the possibility to parole after 20 years. But then again, he's 73. He's not.
Right.
You ain't got 20 years, bro. Now, immediately after this conviction, he begins to appeal over and over again to every single court that he can. On February 13th, 2015, an Illinois court upholds the murder conviction but vacates the kidnapping and abduction convictions of an infant due to the statute of limitations. Again, what?
Yeah, I think we should probably just throw those away.
Yeah, I think statute of limitations, like, I know where there's like some things that it makes sense, but like abduction, murder, anything like that. I don't think there's murder. I don't think on any murder there's statute of limitations at all.
Well, there is, right? With him.
No, he still is convicted of the murder. Only the kidnapping and abduction is taken away.
Okay.
So yes, you did murder her, but we can't charge you with kidnapping because statute of limitations. But that doesn't really do much for him because he still has his life sentence because mm-hmm. that's what the murder charge got him. So then he also appeals to the DeKalb County state attorney, Richard Schmack. And Schmack performs an extensive review of the case and all the evidence and all the different case files from the FBI, local, state, cold case, you know, all these things. He concludes that McCullough could not have committed the crimes. I'm calling him McCullough now because that's what he is in the records at this point because his name was legally changed. Could not have committed this crime. And was innocent based on the fluctuating, loosely supported timeline that the investigation had uncovered, the most recent one, citing that the roads were super icy. There's no way that he could have drove 40 miles in that time and murdered her and kidnapped her at 6:20. But 6:20 is not, we don't know that that's the exact time. It's not like someone had a watch that they stopped at that exact moment that she was abducted. We don't know that. It's just, it was around 6:20.
Right.
We know that she ate at 5, probably ate for 30 minutes and was out by 5:30, playing out there for a little bit before he comes in. And it was getting dark at that point. So there's just so many different things. And he basically says, like, you don't have enough evidence to charge him with that. So nope. Then he throws out Eileen's deathbed confession that started this whole reopening of the case, saying that she, because she had cancer and was on morphine at the time that she said this, with her doctor noting that she was, quote, disoriented, it couldn't hold up. So in March of 2016, there's another court hearing that vacates the original conviction and sentencing. They order a new trial, but it never happens because they don't have enough evidence to take him to trial. And he's officially declared innocent by the DeKalb County Circuit Court on April 12th, 2017.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this he's a case, free man right now.
I don't know if he's alive, maybe, but I don't know. But that's the case. Like, this is, it's been solved and unsolved and solved and unsolved.
How's that even fucking happen?
I don't know. I want to like wrap up with what Maria's family has done in her honor. The Maria Ridolph Memorial Map, which is an 8-foot square map of Sycamore constructed of steel and porcelain that was mounted on the front exterior of the Sycamore Municipal Building in 1958. The map was removed in 2002 and replaced with a bronze memorial plaque that was installed on the pedestal outside of the building. And Maria's family also established the Maria Ridolph Memorial Fund that was originally used to pay for the memorial map and was later used as a scholarship, compassion, and summer camp fund for local children in need. And a portion of the proceeds from Charles Lackman's book in 2014 about the case called Footsteps in the Snow was donated to the fund. And wow. That's the case. I really hope this case gets solved, but I feel like they've already solved it. They just didn't have enough evidence to definitively say.
Yeah, no, I think he's guilty.
Me too. I think he's guilty of sin.
Yeah.
So
he'll burn now.
Yeah. And we can rest assured with that.
Wow. Amen. That's sad.
Yeah. Really fucking horrible. Yeah.
Well, covered it well. Thank you.
Guys, we'll talk to you next Thursday.
See ya.
Unless you're on Patreon, because we talked to you before.
Every day, before and after. Love you, bye.
In our group message, love you, bye.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.